This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a better time to do business in Western Australia. Our network of global investment and trade offices connects you to our world-leading industries and highly skilled workforce. Western Australia. It's like no other.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello. When Ulysses S. Grant became the Republican U.S. president in 1869, he'd already won the American Civil War as leader of the Union Army. Now he aimed to tackle a peace. His goal was to reconstruct a divided America and to ensure that all former slaves would now be truly free, be equal citizens, and able to vote. Yet he faced strong and persistent resistance from Southern Democrats who still champion white supremacy, bolstered by the Ku Klux Klan and its lynchings. He found it harder to enforce laws than fight wars, and by the end of his second term, U.S. politics had turned its attention from Reconstruction to the economy, and for decades afterwards, his critics had the loudest voices. With me to discuss President Ulysses S. Grant are Robert Cook, Professor of American History at the University of Sussex, Eric Matheson, Lecturer in U.S. History at the University of Kent, and Susan Mary Grant, Professor of American History at Newcastle University. Susan Mary, what was Grant's background, starting with his early life?
Well, Grant's background wasn't particularly successful. It was very erratic, you know, it was up and down. And he was born in Ohio, which was interesting because, of course, he was born on the banks of the Ohio, on the other side from Kentucky. And that was a division between slavery and freedom in America. So, you know, symbolically, he was born where much of his life was going to be lived out conceptually. But also he married, there was slavery in the family. He married a woman, Julia Dent, who was a slaveholder, came from a slaveholding family. So from the very beginning, Grant was aware of the clash between slavery and non-slavery in America. But his early life was just a difficult one. He graduated from West Point in 1843, and that was all fine. He fought in the Mexican War, which was 1846 to 48, and that was fine, not for the Mexicans, perhaps. And then he left the army in 1854, and over a multitude of things, I think. He did not cope well with other individuals who were very ambitious. From the very beginning, Grant tended to fall prey to other people's ambition, and that was a difficulty.
In what way?
He wasn't very good at the politicking. He wasn't very good, I guess, at the, you know, the smoke-filled rooms and sorting things out. And other men took advantage of that. And I think that is what happened in 1854. And then after that, between 54 and the outbreak of the Civil War, it was a very difficult life. He, you know, he moved to Missouri, back to his wife's father's farm. He tried to make a go of that, and it was fine for a while, but then it wasn't.
But then he got into the army when the Civil War started, and very soon, because it was only a short, well, short 4 years war, he was commanding the Union forces, which was could be called meteoric, not to exaggerate. Mm-hmm. How did he get that far that fast? What were his qualities?
Well, at first the same problems happened. He fought in the West rather than the Eastern Theatre, and the Eastern Theatre, because it was close to Washington, is where all the action was. So at first he was largely invisible.
Yeah, but when he started to be visible, how did he get to the top?
Because I think he was successful. I mean, that was the thing.
Yeah, but
he turned around. He had two successes early in the war where he managed to get two important forts on the Mississippi to surrender, Forts Henry and then Fort Donelson. So that was point number one. And then the second thing was at Shiloh, a very famous battle, which easily could have been a Union defeat. I mean, literally, the troops landed, got off the train and went in the wrong direction. And Grant managed to turn this around and turn it into a victory. So I think gradually Lincoln started to see that this was a man who was successful and also a man who actually was active. The problem that Lincoln had was his most famous general, a man called George B. McClellan, who headed the Army of the Potomac, brilliant administrator, but having made the army, he just didn't want to use it. And so Lincoln went through a series of generals and he couldn't find one that was actually successful. And Grant seemed to him to be somebody who would be successful. So he brought him back from the West along with Sherman. And, you know, Grant proved Lincoln right. He proved to be, you know, brilliant.
There was an idea that Grant was a very cruel general. Is there any evidence for that?
No, he wasn't at all. I think that's just something that his enemies emphasised later, and it's also part, I think, of the myth of the lost cause, where after the Civil War, the former Confederate states, they basically make their defeat seem like the result of being outgunned, but it just wasn't true. It is true that toward the end of the war, when Grant was in charge, the Union Army was conducting a different kind of warfare. It wasn't single battles. He had this campaign called the Overland Campaign, better known as the Wilderness, which was just devastating. In the first 2 weeks of the Wilderness, the death toll for the Union Army was about 18,000, which was just terrible. But Grant hated it. He really hated it. He struggled to cope with the numbers of dead, and he struggled with the whole aftermath of battle. So he was not cruel, but his enemies, of course, called him Grant the Butcher.
And he was extremely successful. And a coin was struck at the end, and on one side was Abraham Lincoln, on the other side was Grant. So he was a national hero, Robert Cook.
He was a national hero at the end of the war. And that, of course, is the key reason why the Republicans decided to nominate him for president in 1868 at their Chicago convention. The Republicans had a very strong, very potent self-image as the party that had spearheaded the successful defence of the Union and in the process liberated...
The Union, in this case, we're talking about the two parts of America.
We're talking about...
That's the way the word is used.
That's right. Successful defence of the United States of America,
yes.
Of the American Republic. In the process of doing that, of course, the Republicans had also played a key role in liberating 4 million black slaves.
And why did they pick on him? It had been 4 years. They'd had a president called Johnson, who they didn't think a great deal of. They thought, to be extremely brief, they thought he was being sort of too feeble and too lean, listening towards the elite of the South, and he wasn't taking advantage of victory as he should do. But why did they pinpoint Grant? He had no experience of politics whatsoever. We've already heard that when he tried to do a bit of politics, he'd be no good at it. So why did they pick him up as their president?
Well, Grant was not a strong party man. In fact, in 1856, he had actually voted for a Democrat in that particular
election. So why did
they
pick him?
So the Republicans picked him in 1868, in large part because they thought he was the man who was going to win the election, but also crucially because he had played an important role in siding with congressional Republicans against what the Republicans perceived to be Andrew Johnson's excessively lenient plan of Reconstruction. What the Republicans feared was that the former Confederates would get back into power very, very quickly after their defeat in 1865. And the Republicans were determined to ensure that the fruits of military victory and the fragile racial promise that went along with that were secured.
How did he react initially to this invitation?
Initially, Grant was not terribly enthusiastic. He certainly did not consider himself a politician. But essentially, he shared the view of the majority of the Republicans that the fruits of a very costly civil war had to be secured. And in terms of costs, of course, the fact that 360,000 Northern soldiers had perished in the course of the conflict. That, for Grant and for many Republicans, was a reason why the great Union commander should be the next president of the United States.
What did the Republican North expect to be the dividend of war? What did they expect to get out of having won the war, which they hadn't got out of it by the time they nominated Grant for president?
The Republicans were determined to ensure future Southern loyalty to the Union. They did not trust the defeated Confederates at this point in time. So I think that is the key dividend. And alongside that, the majority of Republicans also wanted to secure the basic civil rights of the freed slaves.
And to take up that point, Eric Matheson, Robert E. Lee, the great general of the South, he surrendered to Grant in the war, but he was very, very leery about conceding him the peace. Is that right?
I think in a lot of ways it was, yeah. I think that there was a very uneasy relationship between the two men, coming on the back of so many battles that they had fought in the latter year and a half of the war, particularly. But there was an uneasy peace, and the arrangement that Grant had sort of come to with Lee was that Lee would go off, because he was such a figurehead, because he was such an important figure. The arrangement was that he was going to go off and be as quiet in his public life as was humanly possible. Grant didn't believe that Lee was going to do this, and he suspected, right up until Lee died in 1870, he suspected that Lee was sort of behind some kind of Machiavellian effort to undermine Reconstruction. And certainly when he became...
Was he right?
I don't think so.
In Grant's time, at least three key amendments were brought to bear on the Constitution in order to support the African Americans.
Yes.
What were they? The 14, 15, and 16. Can you briefly tell us?
It was actually the 13th, 14th, 13th. And 15th
Missed
amendments.
Missed out the 13th. No. Right, let's start there.
That's all right. The 13th Amendment was passed just as the war was ending. It was ratified at the end of 1865. It was an amendment that banned slavery and involuntary servitude. With the exception of those who had committed a crime and had been convicted of a crime. That would become very important in the decades that would follow. The 14th Amendment was probably the most expansive amendment. It cemented a piece of legislation that Republicans had passed earlier, which granted civil rights to African Americans and basically put the power of the federal government behind ensuring that neither race, creed, or previous condition of servitude was going to abridge or infringe upon any opportunities that people would have to exert the rights of citizens. It did, for the first time, insert the word man into the text of the Constitution, which was a body blow to the women's movement in the United States, and it would take decades for the women's movement to recover from that. And the final amendment was the amendment that was basically being discussed as Grant becomes president. And that was really up in the air as to what Grant would do. The 15th Amendment explicitly gave African-American men the right to vote. It was a very simple language in that amendment. And it was unclear, even at the point when Grant was giving his inaugural address, what he would do or whether he would support this amendment. In the end, he did. And he did so in a very kind of bold fashion in his inaugural address. And that ultimately got that
what
amendment.
What was the fashion?
Pardon me?
What did he say that was bold?
In his inaugural address, he really came out and said that it was the price that the nation had to pay, or the price that the South in particular had to pay for the war. That was the only way that the gains that the Union had accrued during the war, it was the only way that those gains could be cemented in law and cemented in the Constitution. And that was, for that reason, I think it was a really bold step. And it was seen as a bold step at the time, too.
And it was radical at the time, Susan McMurray. I would have thought that he was going to push this through, and he put his weight behind it. How far did he get with that? This period is known as the Reconstruction. They're reconstructing, trying to bring the North and South together, also trying to fulfil their promises to African Americans and later to the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. So a lot of reconstructing is going on. Can you take the basic one, that follow up from what's been said?
Well, I think the difficulty was, I mean, the first thing is that these amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th, they didn't happen all of a piece and at once. So the 13th Amendment, if anyone's seen the film Lincoln, will know that that got pushed through. Very close vote. The 14th Amendment wasn't fully ratified by Congress until 1868. So there's a long period of arguing about this in the nation and in the South specifically. And the problem was Grant faced he faced with two problems. He faced the real ingrained racism of a lot of white Southerners and also some Northerners. But he also faced a kind of disinterest from many Northern reformers. Again, not all, but many of them. William Lloyd Garrison, for example, the most famous abolitionist, he was the editor of The Liberator. After the Civil War and after the 13th Amendment, he shut up shop. He closed down his paper. He said, well, that's that. Done deal. And did something else with his life. And so there was that kind of taking their eye off the ball. And that was the problem. Because I think one of the things Americans, and anybody really, still does not understand is quite how dreadful the violence in Reconstruction was. In the early period,
So-called Reconstruction, of the so-called amendments being put into practice, the violence
the reaction against it, the violence against it in the southern states was just horrific.
For instance?
Well, there were several massacres which took place. I mean, again, that people know these massacres took place. There was
one famous one in New Orleans.
But it was the levels of violence, I think, that attended these. So one can glibly say it was a massacre in New Orleans, and what does it actually mean? And what it actually meant, it was just really horrific. It was akin to a contemporary school shooting. The police actually, you know, went into a black church and massacred the congregation. And this happened more than once, three or four times in the early Reconstruction period. And, of course, Grant is not president at first in the early Reconstruction period. And just following on from Robert's point, I mean, one of the reasons that he comes to prominence, he's not invisible. He's doing a kind of tour of the states where he's you know, applauded. And on one occasion, he has to announce he can't shake hands anymore because his hand is so swollen. And so people increasingly, I think, not only saw him as a military hero, but because he was a military hero, they thought he is what we need to try and deal with this violence because it's so terrible, out of control.
And how did he then, Robert Cook? What did he do to deal with the violence?
He took a number of steps. Firstly, he threw his weight, as we've heard, behind the 15th Amendment, behind ratification of the 15th Amendment. That's a very important position that Grant
took. What did he do practically?
Well, for example, he encouraged the governor of Nebraska to hold a special session in order to get the state of Nebraska to ratify as quickly as possible. He made it very clear to congressional Republicans that he supported ratification of the 15th Amendment as an essential piece in the jigsaw, really, essential to preserving, securing the fruits of Northern military victory.
But we've heard about massacres, and you've drawn back from the details are quite horrible about the number of lynchings.
Yes,
but then the Ku Klux Klan comes on the scene as a force, as a guerrilla force, let's say that. And he took them on, didn't he? Can you tell us?
He
sent in soldiers to tackle them and to get rid of them.
He did. The Ku Klux Klan was initially a fraternal organisation set up by Confederate veterans in Tennessee, and it rapidly became one of many white supremacist terrorist organizations active in the southern states during the late 1860s and early 1870s. Grant acted pretty decisively against the Klan in 1871 when the Republican governor in South Carolina called for assistance. Grant sent in troops, and the Klan was successfully suppressed in a number of counties in South Carolina. But it's important, I think, to recognise that the Klan was just one of many white supremacist terrorist groups. There was the White League in Louisiana, for example, and crucially, these groups were aligned with the Democratic Party in the South. And perhaps some of our listeners might be surprised to learn that the Democratic Party was not the progressive liberal force that it is in the United States. Today, in the 19th century, the Democratic Party was the party of small government, and it was also the party of white supremacism as well.
So let's just develop this, because The laws have said you can't do this. He sends in an army to enforce the laws. And yet there are hundreds of... I've mentioned lynchings once. I'll mention it again. There are hundreds of lynchings going on. So he couldn't be everywhere. The army couldn't be anywhere, everywhere. And there's intimidation going on a very wide scale. I come to him once. Can you just finish that? The thought that I... That I've
that's a very important point. There were just a few thousand federal troops in the South during the 1870s. Most of them were stationed in towns and cities. So life was particularly hard for African Americans, hard and dangerous for African Americans living in the southern countryside. And they certainly could not be protected on a regular basis by federal troops. And Grant was always very wary of sending troops in, because he understood that the Democrats, Northern Democrats as well as Southern Democrats, would make hay if he did send in federal troops. They would attack him for being a Caesar and a tyrant.
Eric Balthasar, you want to develop this?
Well, I think it's important to note, too, that in as much as African Americans wanted desperately, in many cases, protection from the federal government, the whole post-Civil War period was a time of paramilitary politics. It's one of the problems, I think, that historians have in talking about the Civil War and wars generally. We're very good at talking about how wars start. We're not so good at talking about how they end, because they never end as cleanly as we would like.
So how did this not end as clean as we would like?
Well, in as much as Grant signed an armistice with Robert E. Lee to end the war in 1865, for most Americans, that war just carried on. It bled into the 1860s and 70s, both for white Southerners returning home, but also for African Americans. So in as much as the Klan was a real force to be reckoned with in many parts of the South, it was still the case that where African Americans made up a numerical majority in counties throughout the South, they practiced a kind of paramilitary politics. When they were given the right to vote, they voted en masse. They oftentimes went to the polls armed as entire communities to protect one another. So that there's a kind of a back and forth, I think, between African Americans and white Southerners throughout this period that gives you a real sense of, just as Susan Mary was saying, the violence. But it was a violence that had a lot of different facets to it.
And also a lot of different groups, as has been pointed out. It wasn't just the Ku Klux Klan. There were other groups. And they weren't going to stop. It was like swept across the South and backwards and forwards, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think the Klan's membership sort of ebbed and flowed. It reached a real crescendo in the lead-up to these constitutional amendments being passed. In many ways, that's why the constitutional amendments were passed in the first place. There was a sense of the federal government needing to step in. But then the Klan kind of dips. Its membership begins to dwindle. And certainly once Grant passes these enforcement acts and basically puts the power of the federal government behind rooting out the Klan through the Justice Department, principally, which was created in 1870 to sort of act as a kind of freedmen's bureau in a way to sort of protect African Americans in small part. Once that happened, the Klan's membership really did dwindle, and they were successful in breaking the back of that particular group. It just changed it did change its shape, but by the 1870s, the Klan would sort of take off in other forms. But Grant was very successful, I think, in that respect.
Well, Susan Mary, where are the African Americans now? These amendments have been passed. Mm. The Klan and, as Roberts pointed out, other groups are doing their best to obstruct mm-hmm. them. We've been told that the intervention of troops caused the Klan's membership to dip. So what's going on? Is there a feeling of, oh, we're getting there for the African Americans? Were they? We've been told they went to the polls and started to vote.
I'm not sure there really was. I think, yes, they went to the polls and started to vote. But even if, as Eric said, they went armed, people could prevent their vote from counting in simple ways if you were, in a position. It's not secret ballot. People can see how you're voting. But in any case, if you walked into a polling station, if you walked into wherever the poll was being organised and you weren't white, they knew how you were going to vote. And in some cases, the person in charge would simply reach their hand into the bowl or the box and take the ballot out and rip it up in front of them. So it wasn't just that you burned crosses on people's lawns, which wasn't so common in that period. You didn't have to use physical violence all the time. You could just make it very clear that you weren't going to allow them to have a political voice. And I think that's one of the issues. I think one of the problems, of course, for emancipation and for African Americans in the United States was the way that emancipation was achieved, the way that it was controlled, and the way that it continued to be controlled after the Civil War during Reconstruction. So it's achieved through a conflict. It's organised things like the American Freedmen's Inquiry Commission, which was set up in 1863, which was still in the middle of the Civil War, to try and see how life would be like for African Americans after slavery had ended. That's organised by the War Department. So it all comes out of the War Department. It's all about military. It's all about the point of a gun. And so they can never really achieve, I think they realise that they can never really achieve any kind of parity of life with their, you know, their white, their white neighbours, because their white neighbours, I mean, not all of them, but many of them are just not prepared to allow this to happen.
Let's switch to the Native Americans now, if we can, Robert, with you, Robert Cook. The West was opening up, business was driving through, there was gold in Nam Nai Hills, the railroad was steaming across backwards and forwards, the whole thing was beginning to take off, the great American business boom, which doesn't seem to stop. How did that affect Native Americans?
You're quite right. Rapid economic development after the American Civil War threatened the traditional way of life of the Plains Indians. In particular, I mean, it threatened their way of life in all kinds of ways, but particularly in terms of the extermination, the rapid extermination of the buffalo. The material and religious culture of the Plains Indians depended very heavily on the buffalo. It was official U.S. Army policy to exterminate the buffalo as quickly as possible because that would put increased pressure on the Plains Indians. Societies were divided between radicals who wanted to resist the encroachment of white settlers and pragmatists like the great Sioux chief Red Cloud, much more pragmatic, realised the consequences of continual warfare against the U.S. Army and sought some kind of compromise. But the economic expansion after the war placed Indian societies under huge strain.
I read that the casualties in the wars on the Great Plains had more casualties than the American Civil War. Is that true? Let's say as many. Is it about?
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest with you.
But there was plenty.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a mass extermination. I mean, the Civil War moved west, basically, after 1865. And the Union Army, was demobbed out of... many were demobbed out of the military. But the people who were left, the soldiers who were left, were sent west. And it was very much about extermination. Grant's policies, though, were quite interesting in that when he came into office, he very much wanted to preserve a sort of a peace with Native Americans. He wanted to, he placed a Native American at the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He made noises, which I don't think were entirely self-serving or just for show. He made noises about very much wanting to kind of preserve a Native way of life. The fact that he was at the head of a government, however, that had been at this point for a few years on the path to extermination is a bit of a gap between rhetoric and reality.
Also, he himself is an expansionist, wasn't he?
Hugely, yeah, very much so. I mean, he was very much of his moment and very much an imperialist. For Grant, in particular, it was seizing or annexing the Dominican Republic. That was really one of his great hopes for his presidency, and it was ultimately, I think, one of his great worries that he hadn't accomplished it, and it was a real burden on him. I think that he hadn't accomplished it. It was a plan that had been in place for some time before he arrived in office, but he single-handedly made every attempt to annex Santo Domingo, largely to provide African Americans with a place to go. This was a colonization effort.
But the story is tilting, because the panic of 1873, the big rush, the big collapse, almost collapse. That hurt Grant's reputation as well as hurt a lot of Americans and Americans' confidence in America.
It depends what side of the fence you're on as to whether it hurt his reputation. The post-war boom that Roberts referred to, a lot of it was speculative. A lot of the former Union generals sunk a lot of their money into the railroad. It was an incredible time of stock speculation and the equivalent, I suppose, of hiding your money offshore. They put it into all kinds of railroad stocks. And so inevitably it was going to come to an end, and that's what it did in 1873. So specie starts to fall. In fact, Grant goes to visit... He goes to visit one of the great financiers who was a friend of his, a man called Jay Cook. And in the course of the evening, Cook is receiving various telegrams, which he just pockets, doesn't see anything. And the next morning, Grant discovers that Cook had gone bankrupt. And that caused other, you know, other parts of the stock exchange to spiral the way these things do. So the long and the short of it is that in the face of this, because the panic of 1873 lasted for about 5-6 years. It took a long time before the economy stabilised. And one of the responses from some of his colleagues in Congress was to basically print more money, which would have been a disaster. But Grant is really being pushed to do this. And he takes the bill home, apparently, and he reads it very carefully and decides he's not going to do this. And so he vetoes it. So the people whose bill it was weren't very happy, but a lot of the bankers and were very pleased and, you know, wrote to thank him and said, this has made, you know, our country will stabilise again because of your decision. So it really tied this idea of the Republicans being a party of stable money. But all through the 19th century, Americans are lurching about between the gold and the silver standard and, you know, political careers die on that hill.
But we've moved quite away from the Reconstruction in the South by this point. We're into the economy. It's part of the same larger story, but African Americans in the South are not top of the priority list.
I suppose they're not, and this is part of the problem. I think as you get towards the end of the Reconstruction period, I guess between 1873 and 1876. So many things. I think people get frustrated. They get frustrated with the violence. I mean, I think as you would do, because it's just impossible to do anything about. They get frustrated by the strikes and the economic collapse. And, you know, they're looking desperately for somebody who's going to resolve that.
And Grant doesn't seem to be the man at this stage in his second term of presidency, Robert Cook.
Well, his second term was certainly not as successful as his first term. There are very few.
But they're looking for somebody to blame, and he carries the can.
Sure. Oh. Northern voters are preoccupied with issues growing out of the panic and the subsequent depression. So they're worried about unemployment. They're worried about depressed farming conditions in the Midwest, for example. They're also worried about corruption as well. And this is a major problem for Grant in his second term. Because there's a growing perception that his administration was corrupt. There are a number of high-profile corruption cases involving his Secretary of War, William Worth Belknap, for example, who was receiving kickbacks on a post-tradership out west. One of his closest advisors, Orville Babcock, was involved in the Whiskey Rings conspiracy. And so there's a growing feeling that the administration itself is corrupt. And this is coupled with a mounting sense that the remaining Republican regimes left in the southern states that are basically being bolstered by federal military force, that these regimes are also corrupt. And this really gives the Democratic Party significant political leverage. The Democrats win control of the House of Representatives in 1874, makes it impossible for Grant to secure passage of further enforcement legislation, even though he personally, I think, would have been willing to send federal troops in to certain states on certain occasions.
So, Eric Matheson, to go back to the South, what's happening when, as it were, he's looking west?
Well, I think that the situation in the South by the middle of the 1870s is becoming very tenuous. African Americans where they were able to, and particularly at the local and state level, and particularly in places where they were a significant part of the population, they had managed to build with white Republican allies some pretty powerful state governments. But the coalitions that kind of knitted those two groups together was beginning to come apart at the seams. And the combination of that, along with this violence, which begins to tick up over the middle 1870s.
So it grows again.
It begins to grow again. And it becomes part of what becomes known in some states as the White Line movement or the White League movement. Connected to the Klan, definitely, connected to vigilante violence, but now they become sort of the armed wing of the Democratic Party, as Robert was saying, and they begin to sort of systematically throw people out of office. This culminates in a series of elections in 1874 and 1875, which around the country were some of the most corrupt elections ever held in American history. Anecdotal stories of ballot boxes being thrown from the windows of passing trains and things being shoved into bills of lading that are sent on ships out of the country. I mean, unbelievable stories of corruption. But there was basically an attempt made on the part
but
of whites.
They were believed.
They ought to be believed. Yeah. I mean, congressional investigations after 1874 made it very clear that this was being done across the board, all in an attempt to redeem, as it became known, redeem the South. There's a sense, I think, that people are tired now of Reconstruction. They want to move on with this. Move on to a rosier future for the country as a whole. And that's where you start to get a kind of a change, not only in how people are thinking about African-Americans, but also how people are thinking about the war. The Civil War starts to loom larger and larger, less as a conflict between two violently opposed sides and more as a conflict between two groups of people that merely disagreed. They had just a disagreement. It becomes a brother's war again.
Meanwhile, the terrorism is going on and on and on.
It is.
It's bitten back into the South as strongly as it ever was in the time of official, as it were, if I can use that word, slavery.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, but it's also not just in the South, and I think we have to remember that. One of the complicating factors of America's Civil War and the Reconstruction that followed it is that not every slaveholding state was part of the Confederacy. So you have states like Kentucky and Missouri that are slaveholding states that never joined the Confederacy, but they become, for some reason, they become the battlegrounds, really, between African-Americans and whites. That more lynchings take place during Reconstruction in Kentucky than at any other time. I mean, you think of lynching in the South, you tend to think of South Carolina, Mississippi, but actually in the early years of Reconstruction, it was Kentucky. So there's a lot of struggle going on there.
And you're talking about hundreds of people being lynched.
Yeah, hundreds of people, yeah. This is clearly much more of a national problem that they can't really get their teeth into, because Grant could have sent more troops into South Carolina, but you know, how would it have gone down if he'd sent troops into Kentucky? It wouldn't have made any sense. People would have said, but these are not the states of the former Confederacy. What are you doing?
So what you're saying, Eric, is that the whites between them said, well, let's sort of forget it and act as if this war was a war between brothers, like the brothers always used. And there's trouble down south, but let them get on with it. I mean, that's a ridiculous shorthand, but is there any sense in it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it becomes one of the reasons that it becomes a brother's war is it becomes very popular in popular culture. So there's a Century Magazine is a very well-known magazine, and it starts publishing a series of articles, Battles and Leaders of the Civil War. And so this is the beginnings of that process where they're starting, as Eric said, to see it as they're trying to reach hands across the stone wall, is the metaphorical phrase, and where they're trying to see it as a war between equals. And it becomes a real point of contention.
It's also worth picking your head up and realizing that in the 1870s and 80s and 90s, at the end of the 19th century, this is an imperial moment around the world for a lot of, you know, white Anglo-Saxon European powers. And the United States begins to see, white Americans begin to see the idea of African Americans having power, having political power, as being something that is against the laws of nature, against the kind of laws of racial doctrine. And that gains real ascendancy as Americans are reading the international news on the one hand and seeing a race for Africa and the British Empire expanding its influence around the world and Americans giving African-Americans meaningful political power. That the argument, the legs get knocked out from under the idea that African-Americans ought to be given this power.
Robert, you wanted to come.
I just wanted to push back slightly against this idea of the Brothers' War coming into vogue so quickly during the 1870s. The last Republican, serious Republican attempt to enforce the 15th Amendment actually takes place in 1890-91. The Republicans are really shocked when they lose the 1884 election to the Democrats. They believe that the election has been stolen by the Democrats in the South. And they push very hard for enforcement of the 15th Amendment in 1890-91. And that attempt is strongly supported by one of the Republicans' key voting blocks in the North, which, of course, is that of Union veterans who are strongly supportive of enforcement legislation as late as 1890-91. So I just want to push back a little bit against that idea of the Brothers' War.
As I understand it, Susan Mary, when Grant wrote his memoirs, he talked about the war but not about the peace.
Yeah, it was mainly focused on the war. I mean, I think that was because that was what was going to sell. It is, as Eric and Robert both said, by this period, Civil War memoirs are flying off the shelves, and a memoir from Grant, you know, the publishers were fighting over it. And it was a memoir of the conflict. I mean, that was really what his memoirs were about.
But at the time his memoir came out, it was a bestseller, and he came to this country, and 100,000 people attended the rally in Newcastle, and on it went. So his popularity was firm.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he did this world tour, and not everyone loved him. The French were not entirely receptive, but you know, he went everywhere. I mean, he went to Egypt, didn't he? He went to Turkey, he went to Calcutta, he went to Jerusalem. He was the first American former president to go to Jerusalem. He came to Britain. He opened the library in Sunderland. So he did many, many things. And, yeah, his profile was high and his popularity was high. And I think one of the reasons is he was, and this is going to sound a bit trite perhaps, but he was a genuinely likeable individual. Although he was reticent and shy, I think he did come across well with people. And they liked him in a way that some politicians were not and are not likeable. Grant was likeable.
His reputation plunged, but now seems to be... And his tomb was neglected and nobody looked after it, and he was the neglected, forgotten, let's not think about him much, president. But he seems to be... His reputation seems to be making a comeback.
Yeah. I think as a result of the sort of lost cause, the notion of Grant as this butcher and this man who loved a particularly destructive war... It fit into a larger story that Americans were telling themselves about the Civil War. It really wasn't until the middle of the 20th century, I think, that people started to think about Grant in some different ways, particularly Grant, the general. And a lot of that had to do with people reading his memoirs a bit more seriously. I mean, for me, at any rate, they are astonishing. His memoirs are probably one of the best examples of American memoir in American history, I think.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Eric Matheson, Robert Cook and Susan Mary Grant. Next week, Sir Thomas Browne, the 17th century doctor and essayist. Virginia Woolf wrote, "Few people love the writings of Sir Thomas Browne, but those who do are the salt of the earth." Thank you very much.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
OK, well, what did we miss out? I can't manage to ask, how did Ku Klux Klan, the words, come into? I couldn't find
it. It's supposed to be from circle. I mean, people, there's arguments about it, but it's meant to be from the Greek for circle, kuklos. That's one of the most likely and least coming out of left field suggestion
used,
I've heard.
I think it was used by a lot of fraternal organisations even before the Civil War.
Yeah,
they like to use the Greek to...
Yes, they did. Well, Americans like to use the whole idea, especially in the South, especially, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was very much that kind of Greek revival.
We didn't bring up the story of how Mark Twain got involved with publishing the memoirs. That might be something to bring up.
Well, there you go. What's the story?
So there's an important story, fascinating story behind the writing of Grant's memoirs. In 1884, Grant went broke. He had invested unwisely in a New York brokerage company that was co-owned by one of his sons, Ulysses. And as a result, Grant knew that he had to do something in order to secure his family's future. And Mark Twain, the celebrated author, he was currently at work on Huckleberry Finn, had just set up his own publishing company. And Twain offered Grant a lucrative contract to publish his memoirs. And as a consequence of that, the Grant family came into a lot of money after Grant's death in July 1885. Hundreds of thousands of dollars were accrued as a consequence. The profits were great. The memoirs were published in two volumes, and while Grant was actually undertaking the writing of the memoirs, he was diagnosed with throat cancer. So he actually wrote the final stages of the memoirs while he was dying, and he just managed to complete the memoirs shortly before his death in July 1885.
There's a very famous photograph of Grant sitting in the veranda of his house and totally in suede and a scarf, right, because, of course, he had a massive tumour, just writing. It's really sad.
It was really a hugely courageous and impressive effort, I think, on
his
part.
Yes, it was. But he loved his wife so very much. Yes. I mean, Julia Dent as well as Julia Grant, I think towards the very end, they behaved like a young married couple. I'm sure their friends loved that. But that's really how they were as a couple. Yeah. And he was so worried about her, I think.
But he was a fantastic writer, which I think came as a real shock to a lot of people.
Yeah, where did he get it from? You don't describe him as a background as a big reader, do you?
No, I don't know where it
Maybe
came
you
from.
Maybe you don't have to read to be a good writer. That could be your
Well, it's entirely possible.
Possibly.
Yeah, but he was astonishing at it. And people have since gone back and read correspondence that he'd written during the war itself, and they found him to be a really good, terse, very to the point, not flowery, very different from William Tecumseh Sherman, who also wrote memoirs before Grant did, which were huge and voluminous and put Sherman at the center of the Shakespearean drama. And Grant's was very different. But I think that's why it still kind of reads so well, is that it was very kind of crisp and to the point.
We didn't talk about General Order 11. Can you explain to people what that was? Do you want to?
Well, this is one of the great mistakes of Grant's life, really. In 1862, he issued General Order 11, which really expressed his frustration with the extent of cotton trading within Union lines, and he felt that merchants were getting in the way of the of his military campaigning. So in this order, he excluded Jews from Union lines because he believed that Jews as a class were heavily involved in cotton trading.
Were they?
No more so than the non-Jews, I think. It was certainly an expression of anti-Semitism. I think grassroots anti-Semitism was rife in the United States during this period. But I think in Grant's defence, he did come to regret the order. He realised it was a big mistake for all kinds of reasons. The issue came up.
What reasons did he put forward?
Well, the issue comes up in the 1868 election campaign because Jewish Americans, who are becoming, not insignificant group within American society, they're not overly excited when Grant is nominated in 1868. So he makes amends. He makes a public retraction of the order. He states very publicly that he does not sustain that order. And he also makes one or two significant appointments of Jewish Americans as well when he enters the White House. So I think he did come to realise that he was wrong to issue that order.
The Native Americans is a sad story. It just gets sadder and sadder, doesn't
it?
And the great battles of the plains. I did read in somebody's notes, I know you took me up on it, so in that case I didn't press it, that as many people have been killed in the Great Plains War as had been killed in the American Civil War. You don't find it. And who wrote that?
Me, I think. Because on the Great Plains they're massacring entire tribal groups, Native nations, women and children. Not to say they didn't do that in the Civil War, but not quite as much. I mean, Civil War death rates used to be sort of stuck at 600,000, and then recently some people counted forward into the census and upped it by 100,000, but many more Native Americans died. I think it's worth it's interesting, though, because Grant, you know, again, Grant was really ahead of his time is the wrong word. He really did genuinely try to make life better for Native Americans. It was just very, very difficult because the world was moving on, and what white settlers wanted on the plains was different from what Native Americans wanted. But Eli Parker, for example, was one of his lieutenant generals, was it? Mm-hmm. Or I mean, he was a Seneca, and he, in fact, drafted the terms of Lee's surrender. And then after the war, Grant made him the Commissioner for Indian Affairs. But the trouble was that some of Grant's former colleagues, generals like Phil Sheridan and Sherman, they were just utterly racist. I mean, Phil Sheridan is the one that the anecdote says, basically said, is not only good Indians are dead Indian. I mean, it really was shocking what went on there. And I think Grant found that hard because these are men he's fought with, and now they're opposing his views.
Grant certainly empathised with Native Americans and their plight. He believed that the settlers were to blame, white settlers were to blame, really, for the for the violence.
But what did he do to try to stop it?
Well, I think that's the key question, really. I think his view was that the only way to prevent them from being exterminated or from vanishing, many Americans at the time simply thought that they would vanish. As progress swept across the West, Grant's view was that they could only be saved if they learned the ways of the of white people. Mm-hmm. So the only way to do that, he believed, was to place them on reservations, make sure that their hunting ways, that their communal society was broken up, that they learned how to undertake commercial farming, that they were taught Christianity. So one could make an argument for saying, well, he wasn't an exterminationist, but he was still still believed that the only way to save the Indians was actually to destroy their traditional culture.
He did see that a lot of the problems was corruption among white officials. He replaced a lot of the officials, Indian agents, who supposedly lived on these newly constructed reservations. And the idea was that money would go to them and they would give the money to the native peoples to do things like build a church, build a schoolyard, whatever. And he realised a lot of that money was not getting to the people it was intended for. So he replaced them all with, first of all, Quakers, and then he just tries to replace them with, you know, religiously inclined individuals who are less keen to do that. But of course, the irony is in the year when Grant, the end of Reconstruction, 1876-77, is the year of, America's centennial, 1876, and it's the year of Little Bighorn, isn't it? So
yes, when miners enter the Black Hills on the Great Sioux Reservation after the discovery of gold.
Ultimately, the Black Hills of Dakota.
Ultimately, Grant decides that he can't use federal troops to prevent the miners encroaching onto the reservation. So there are tremendous constraints, I think, on Grant and what he can actually do to protect Native Americans during this period.
And it was kind of an unstoppable force. Of not just kind of this idea of civilization, but also the fact that the railroads were gobbling up enormous tracts of land.
Yeah.
And that was the real power in the Republican Party by the time you get to Grant's administration.
And that comes out of the Civil War, of course.
Yeah.
Because once the railroads are there, there's no upside it were high, does there, really?
Absolutely.
That's right.
And that's where a lot of the corruption comes from, too. You know, the Republican national chairman was in the pay of four different railroads by the time he was...
a lot of them were.
By the time he was in the 1860s and 70s. I mean, they controlled so much, they had so much patronage power, that the idea of protecting Native Americans was just... I mean, it was a trifle. There was nothing to be done to stand in the way of these enormous railroad barons sort of getting their way.
Did one of you use the word genocide?
Well, genocide is used sometimes in relation to what happens to Native Americans. Obviously, every time the word genocide is used, it's contested, but I think it's probably accurate because it was consistent on the part of white people, and it was determined, and it was deliberate. They expected the land. I mean, this is part of the problem, that during the Civil War, they'd passed legislation, the Homestead Act, Pacific Railroad Act, specifically to help people move west. And of course, when the war ended, they had these expectations that they were going to be able to. I mean, this is the eternal American story. Go west, go west, go west. And, you know, they find some natives in the way, more natives perhaps than the original settlers had found in Jamestown even. And it's just a bad, bad ending for the natives. But this goes on all the way through. I mean, the Dawes Settlement Act, it goes all the way through into the 20th century, trying to control.
And the Ku Klux Klan, to finish on that, to come back to that, that goes very much on into the 20th century, doesn't it?
There's a revival, it's a different kind of organisation. Yeah.
They reached their peak in the 1920s.
Yeah, but it's not just anti-African-American,
it's
by that
anti-Catholic,
point. It's anti-Catholic,
anti-Jewish,
yes. Anti-women with short skirts, it's anti-everything.
Yeah.
They've expanded their remit.
Yeah.
But those, I mean, it's the 1920s, you have these photographs of the Klan marches down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, and they are quite terrifying. I mean, Europeans perhaps have to keep in perspective that this is not Nuremberg, but these rallies are nevertheless designed to be intimidating. Because the original Klan didn't have the white hoods. They had masks, which were very scary, and but they didn't have this kind of costume of the white hood that they've become famous for.
Yeah.
Birth of a Nation did that, yes, the film Birth of a Nation.
Yeah. Well, thank you all very much. The producer's trying to get in.
Do you want your coffee?
I'd love a coffee, please.
Coffee, please.
Lovely.
Three coffees, Melvin.
I'd like a coffee, please, as well.
What did the S stand for, by the way?
It was a mistake. It was a bureaucratic error.
His first name was Hiram.
In Our Time with Melvin Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
This is Planet Puffin.
There's a fair chance you will get bitten at some point.
Planet Puffin is a new podcast coming to you from a tiny island off the east coast of Scotland.
Across the summer, we're going to be following the breeding season, no matter what it takes.
Now, there's an encouraging piece of poo at the entrance.
There's some nice white guano.
So, Becky, I'm going to let you take the first game of Puffin Roulette.
Summer 2019's hottest Puffin podcast.
Well, only Puffin podcast.
For BBC Sounds.
There's never been a better time to do business in Western Australia. Our network of global investment and trade offices connects you to our world-leading industries and highly skilled workforce. Western Australia. It's like no other.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.